I'm Rosemary Martirana, Director of Intelligence here at the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness, NJOHSP, and you're listening to Intelligence Unclassified. This podcast is exactly what the title states, unclassified information about current trends in homeland security for the state of New Jersey, as well as educational information and resources for your awareness. Although it is produced every month, we aim to stay on top of current events and will often offer additional content. If this is your first time listening, then thanks for coming. Please feel free to add this podcast to your RSS feed or iTunes. You can also follow NJOHSP on Twitter at NJOHSP and Facebook. All links can be found in the show note and on our website, www.njohsp.gov.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another installation of Intelligence Unclassified. This is Jenna Raymond. I'm an intelligence analyst at the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness. Today on Intelligence Unclassified, we're talking to Barak Mendelson, professor of political science at Haverford College and a senior fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute. In addition to teaching, Professor Mendelson also oversees the Global Terrorism Research Project at Haverford, which focuses on statements and messages from Al-Qaeda Central. Professor Mendelson has a bachelor's degree in Middle East Studies from the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, a master's degree in Security Studies from Tel Aviv University, a second master's in government from Cornell, and to top all that off, he has a PhD in government also from Cornell. At the beginning of 2016, he published a second book called The Al-Qaeda Franchise, The Expansion of Al-Qaeda and Its Consequences, in which he argues that Al-Qaeda's branching out strategy of expansion was a response to Al-Qaeda's decline after the 9/11 attacks. It might be a little obvious at this point, but today we're going to be talking about Al-Qaeda. We'll go over the group's current and future leadership. We'll discuss what's going on with some of the affiliates. And finally, we'll talk about an Intelligence Unclassified favorite, Battle of the Brands, Al-Qaeda versus ISIS. So, Professor Mendelson, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
First, I want to talk about Al-Qaeda's leadership. Ayman al-Zawahiri is the leader of the group now. In 2014 to 2015, he went for almost a year. We didn't hear from him for a year. Personally, I was starting to think he was dead. When Nasser al-Wahishi died, the leader of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, he died in June 2015, and I thought, Zawahiri has to speak. He has to say something, but we didn't hear anything. Then when the Taliban finally let it be known that Mullah Omar had been dead for over 2 years, I thought again, Zawahiri has to say something. And he finally did, a little late. So why do you think he was silent for almost a year? Was it just operational security? Do you think something else was happening behind the scenes?
Well, first, I have to say that I'm speculating.
Yeah, of course.
I don't have enough information. I think that you're perfectly right that he had to speak when Mullah Omar became known that Mullah Omar is dead. At that point, everybody, he had to speak. He had to give allegiance to the successor. Previous cases, he didn't have to speak. It was weird that he didn't speak, but he didn't have to. I think that the number of reasons, operational security definitely sounds like a very important one, especially because of the circumstances where his survival was not just important because the U.S. is going after him, but his survival, especially at that time, was important because Al-Qaeda was facing the threat from the Islamic State, and they had to keep him alive because there was a risk that if Zawahiri dies, then all the branches will unravel, the whole organization will unravel, and many of the branches will join the Islamic State. So that seems to me like the main operational security reason. Now, it could be also that at first, the way that he wanted to deal with the Islamic State was not to get straight into direct confrontation or battle of words with the Islamic State, and he let his action help. So the announcement of the establishment of Al-Qaeda in the Indian subcontinent that came in September of 2014. So they preferred to deal with the Islamic State by taking action, showing that they are relevant rather than having all those debates, which came before, came later on. Now, I think that another aspect is that Azam al-Amriki died around the same time.
Yeah.
And he had a major role in guiding Al-Qaeda's media. So it's not clear to what extent the issue is just Zawahiri's security. It might be that the issue was the security of people in the media division of Al-Qaeda.
So do you think maybe it was sort of they took some time to regroup?
It's very possible that they took some time to regroup, or that they couldn't be sure that their connection to Zawahiri is not going to expose Zawahiri. Mm-hmm. So they had, because they might have been penetrated, they needed to be more careful.
Okay, so if we back up just a little bit, when Osama bin Laden was killed, it seemed like there was possibly some disagreement within the Al-Qaeda network about Zawahiri, you know, being the next leader. Do you think that's the case, that not everyone in that network supported him right away?
I'm sure that not everyone supported him right away. And there were rumors that Saif al-Adel was going to be the next leader. It's really hard to tell how much of that is true, since Saif al-Adel was still under basically house arrest in Iran at that point. It makes sense that not everybody was enthusiastic about Zawahiri, because you never had consensus about Zawahiri. He always had lots of people that hated his guts, that found him annoying and out of touch and grumpy. It's really hard to imagine at that point that there was, I guess they still had the Libyans that could have, somebody could have taken, assumed that position, but he was still the most obvious choice. I'm sure that there was some disagreement, but it made sense that it took them a few weeks in order to get feedback from the different branches, make sure that they're not really taking much bigger chance than they would have liked. So yes, I'm sure that there was some disagreement, but I don't think it was any serious disagreement. We would have heard about that by now.
Okay. So you just think it was, you know, a little bit of maybe negotiating some different things, but that everyone was going to agree on him eventually.
Probably, because he's not the ideal candidate, but he was still, seemed like the most obvious candidate.
I mean, he was there since the beginning, but he is getting older. You know, he's in his 60s. We don't know if he has any health issues. We don't know if he has consistent access to medical care. And it's always possible he could die in a targeted drone strike. If he does die in, say, the next year or two, who do you think would follow him? Are any of the affiliate leaders really primed to take over the entire network?
What I saw in the last couple of years, maybe a little bit more since the beginning of the Arab revolutions, is a shift of Al-Qaeda Central basically from the Afghanistan-Pakistan area to the heart of the Middle East. So you had al-Wahaishi in Yemen becoming number two in Al-Qaeda. The first time that the leader of a branch is becoming a face of Al-Qaeda Central. So that was a big change. Then there were lots of senior Al-Qaeda leaders that moved to Syria.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems that most of the people in Al-Qaeda Central are now not really in Afghanistan, Pakistan. And maybe that's one of the main reasons why what we hear now from that region, mostly statements from Al-Qaeda in the Indian subcontinent. I do think that the people from that are now in the Middle East are most likely to replace him. I would still assume that the leadership of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula is most likely, because they are the most trusted ones, at least from all the branches. But it could be somebody from the old guard that moved to Syria.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, can't really tell who is going to survive. At this point, it seems like Zawahiri's chances of survival is much better than the leadership that he sent to Syria.
Yeah, that's true. I know, like, last year when Wahishi was still alive, I probably would have picked him as the next leader. But now, you know, he died, I think, slightly over a year ago. I don't really see Al-Rimi kind of stepping up. But, I mean, do you think the new leader would have to come from the old guard? You know, someone who knew bin Laden and worked with him? Or with somebody younger who's sort of in the middle of, you know, the main fight in Syria right now, like Abu Muhammad al-Julani, who's leading the Nusra Front? Mm-hmm. You know, would he be maybe a better fit for leadership?
I think that somebody from the old guard still has a better chance. Maybe not somebody that fought in the 1980s, but somebody that was around from the 1990s seem very plausible to me. The best way is to try to see who Al-Qaeda is sending to give statements. That's usually the way that they roll them and introduce them. Now, if Zawahiri survives long enough, it could be bin Laden's son.
He's been making statements.
He's been groomed. He has the pedigree, but he needs some time. So if Zawahiri dies now, Probably not. But if Zawahiri dies in 5 years, that's a completely different story. As for Al-Julani, I don't think that Al-Julani is really going to be a good candidate, or anybody from Jabhat al-Nusra itself, from the branch itself, because that branch is not reliable enough. They are focused on the fight in Syria. To make al-Julani the next leader would suggest that you're exposing Jabhat al-Nusra even more to external attacks, that you're undermining their position in Syria. So that just doesn't seem like the best option. But again, these things move so fast. Circumstances on the ground keep changing.
I could see how maybe Julani wouldn't be the best choice. Because over the past year, there have been all these rumors that maybe the Nusra Front would leave al-Qaeda and sort of just pursue their role in the Syrian conflict. Which, I mean, just a few weeks ago, Zawahiri put out, you know, just a short little 10-minute statement kind of saying, you know, he addressed the greater Mujahideen, but also said a few times specifically to the Nusra Front, you're very precious to us, you're very important. He kind of said, please don't leave us.
Well, yeah, it was please don't leave us, but it was, I read it more as, please remember to play nice with the other groups in Syria. That's really important for us.
That's true, because the Nusra Front is al-Qaeda's representative in the most important conflict that's going on right now. On a side note, Professor Mendelsohn and I had this discussion in early July. Later in the month, the leader of the Nusra Front, Abu Muhammad al-Julani, issued a video statement announcing the cessation of operations under the name Jabhat al-Nusra, or the Nusra Front. Julani said the group would be known as Jabhat Fatah al-Sham, and the new organization had no affiliation to any external entity. But what does that actually mean? In the days leading up to this announcement, analysts were speculating that Julani would announce a complete split from al-Qaeda. And we've heard rumors about this for over a year. However, his statement was ambiguous. He did not revoke his pledge of allegiance from Ayman al-Zawahiri, al-Qaeda's central's leader. And the statement about having no affiliation to external groups may have been very carefully written. There are almost certainly senior al-Qaeda leaders in Syria, in which case al-Qaeda central would not be considered external. It's going to take some time to really nail down how this relationship has changed, if indeed it has changed at all. Professor Mendelsohn and I talk about the Nusra Front a few more times during this podcast, so just keep this new development in mind as you listen. Well, since we're talking about the affiliates, I do have some questions about, you know, a couple of the other affiliates. It seems like right now, for several years, AQAP, the Nusra Front, AQIM, Al-Shabaab, and AQIS have been acting in their own self-interest, with oftentimes no major pursuit of Al-Qaeda Central's, you know, grand plan. How much control do you think Al-Qaeda Central has over the affiliates?
Al-Qaeda Central doesn't have as much control as they would like, but I think that they managed to portray sufficient guidelines for the affiliates to follow. And yes, there are problems with the affiliates pursuing some of their own interest that doesn't seem to follow the strategy of Al-Qaeda Central. But the main problem here seems to me the deficiency of the Al-Qaeda strategy, because Al-Qaeda wants to have a war against the far enemy, yet it relies on branches in the Middle East, and that creates tension. Many of the people in those branches, at least the foot soldiers, are more interested in the local conditions. And the leadership of the branches, they need to mitigate or find the balance between the expectations of Al-Qaeda Central and what rank and file in their arena are interested in. So this creates a problem. And so I think the problem is the strategy. Now, beyond that, I think that there is a limited control, and it seems even less control because the situation on the ground changed so fast and the branches have to respond quickly. Not all the time they will have the links to Al-Qaeda Central to be able to give them the instructions in real time. And sometimes there are temptations that you just can't avoid. For example, Bin Laden was not a big fan of controlling territory in Yemen. But then you have the Arab revolutions, and suddenly Al-Qaeda in Yemen is facing a vacuum. If it won't grab that opportunity, then somebody else is going to. So there are some temptations on the ground that force those groups to act in a way that seems to conflict with the way that, with the general strategy of Al-Qaeda Central. I'm not sure that Al-Qaeda Central sees that really as a significant destruction. You see that in the Indian subcontinent, they do continuously remind operatives that they should be careful with the way that they treat civilians. You don't see many calls to the different affiliates in the Middle East to correct their ways or to be more cautious. It seems like everybody there is actually a lot more on the same page as Al-Qaeda Central. It's just that the arena is so chaotic that if one of the main objectives of Al-Qaeda Central now is to actually get closer to the people, then it makes sense that the actions of Al-Qaeda branches in the Middle East are those that bring them closer to the local population, even if it means less focus on the United States. In general, Al-Qaeda is speaking so much about the foreign enemy, but we saw so little action, even from Al-Qaeda Central, so little action against the United States that in some ways it almost seems like just constant rhetoric. And at least from their perspective, the United States and the West are providing such a rich environment for targeting inside the Middle East that they can find a way to make it seem like it fits.
I want to talk about one of the groups I'm sort of fascinated by, Al-Qaeda and the Islamic Maghreb, AQIM. A couple of years ago, they kicked out one of their commanders, Mokhtar Boumokhtar. He went off, you know, started his own group. It was eventually known as Al-Mura Batoon. He swore allegiance directly to Zawahiri. And then at the end of last year, 2015, AQIM announced what we've kind of been calling a re-merger, you know, between AQIM and Al-Mura Batoon. For several years, we saw AQIM sort of bread and butter attacks, you know, either against small groups of military members or security forces, or they would try kidnapping Westerners in order to either get ransom money or, you know, do some kind of prisoner swap. However, in recent months, starting at the end of 2015, AQIM has carried out larger attacks against civilian locations like hotels, restaurants, beachfront resorts. Do you think this is a result of Boumokhtar's influence again in AQIM, or is AQIM just trying to outbid ISIS groups that have moved into AQIM's traditional area of operations?
I don't really see the contradiction. I think that the addition or re-addition of Al-Mura Batoon definitely helped Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb to get into locations in the Sahara Desert, in the Sahel, that they didn't really have enough access to before, and at the time where in Algeria it's more difficult to operate. So it made sense to me that they're trying to go in directions where they can. They try to cross the border into neighboring countries. But then, of course, there is also the competition with the Islamic State. And since the Islamic State gained Boko Haram, it was really important for Al-Qaeda to show that it can have presence in the area as well. And in that regard, Al-Mura Batoon provides them the infrastructure that they needed. So these kind of activities fulfill multiple purposes.
What kind of role do you think that Boumokhtar is playing right now? Because he swore direct allegiance to Zawahiri. And now if they've re-merged with AQIM, you know, I assume that he's got some sort of chain of command. I don't know what kind of role he's playing.
Yes, he has a chain of command. It doesn't mean that he's going to follow the chain of command.
True.
But there is a good chance that now, since they re-merged, there were some negotiations beforehand and some clarifications of what are his responsibilities and how to get along with the leadership of the branch there. So I think that those problems were probably sorted for a while. I doubt that he gave up on his leadership aims, but he probably figured out that this is the best way for him to gain leadership. And there is a good chance that after a while, Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb decide that they're going to branch out and turn Al-Mura Batoon into an official branch, not just a part of Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. So it could be that he's positioning himself for that kind of organizational expansion in the future.
I think you're probably right, because, I mean, I think if you ask him, he probably voluntarily left AQIM, but it seems like it was more he wasn't playing along, so they kind of asked him to leave in the most friendly way you can do that. But yeah, I think you're right. He's probably has some higher aims that he'd like to get to. I want to talk a little bit about AQAP and the Nusra Front. You know, for several years, AQAP, we've considered them the most capable al-Qaeda affiliate. But right now, the most important fight in the Mujahideen universe that, you know, we just talked about it a few minutes ago is in Syria, where the Nusra Front is representing al-Qaeda. Do you think the Nusra Front could sort of eclipse AQAP and take that top spot just because of their location and their importance right now?
I don't think so, because that would require them, as I said, to change the orientation from the Syria arena to the international arena. And that doesn't serve the organizational purposes. I think that it's important for al-Qaeda to keep the Nusra Front focused on what happens in Syria. And that probably that's one of the reasons why they send the senior operatives from al-Qaeda Central into Syria to make sure that that actually happens. There are also some splits with all the two camps within Jabhat al-Nusra, and some of them are more moderate than one faction is a lot more extreme. And so I don't think that Jabhat al-Nusra is in a position we can assume a lot more responsibility at that point. They definitely don't have the same credibility or dependability from al-Qaeda's perspective as al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. So I don't see that happening in the near future.
I know I've seen the media said that the Nusra Front is made up of 70 to 80% of just sort of local Syrian fighters who they don't like the Assad regime. They really don't like ISIS. And the Nusra Front was just sort of the strongest force they could go to try to combat, like, you know, Assad and ISIS. And that those people would not buy into any kind of al-Qaeda network. Again, like, you're right. Like, the Nusra Front probably hasn't proven themselves as a group that could lead the entire network.
And it doesn't seem that they're still interested in that. They have such a big task without having to deal with what's going on outside of Syria. Not before the war actually ends.
And then I want to talk about al-Qaeda's newest affiliate, al-Qaeda in the Indian subcontinent. They haven't been very successful plotting or carrying out a lot of attacks that get media attention. Do you think they're kind of this a lame duck group, or will they attempt to bolster their reputation in some way?
I don't think they're a lame duck group. Taking over many of the responsibilities that Al-Qaeda Central had in Afghanistan, we found out in the past year that they had pretty large training camps in Afghanistan, training hundreds, even thousands of foot soldiers. So that's significant. They also carried out assassinations in Bangladesh. Mm-hmm. They don't get the same publicity, even their actions in Pakistan. But there is such a mess in that region that in order to actually get to us, that we will actually hear about their actions, they need to do something that is really extraordinary. Since in Pakistan, there's so many actors that are bombing things that I think that that's more complicated for them. I'm not sure that they are supposed to be, or at least at this point, they don't seem to be, the utility doesn't need to focus on their operations. Yes, at the beginning when they were announced, they tried some very daring operations on the high seas, trying to take over a Pakistani ship that will then approach an American destroyer, I think it was, and bomb
it. It was very lofty.
Very lofty. And naturally, those plans didn't really work out. Since then, we haven't seen any significant plan. That doesn't mean that they're not important. It just means that for the things that we usually identify as indicators of force, they're just not focused on those.
But if they are training, you know, hundreds or thousands of people, it's almost like they're functioning as the rebuilding unit of al-Qaeda.
That's true. Rebuilding unit. And they also are rebuilding or improving their relationship with the Taliban. I think that especially after the rise of the Islamic State, al-Qaeda is so much clearer about its positive relation with the Taliban in a way that we didn't hear about before, that they're trying to provide services, they're trying to be the good actor, the loyal group. And yeah, so they're building the force, and they might use those people to support Taliban forces, or they might use them for some activities in Pakistan, or they might send some people to the Middle East later on. But in general, I think they're fulfilling an important role for the organization, even if we don't hear that much from them in terms of operations.
Since you just mentioned ISIS, I want to start talking about, you know, in our office, we love talking about this feud between Al-Qaeda and ISIS. We've actually done a previous podcast on it that we called Battle of the Brands. So we've seen Al-Qaeda calling ISIS and Baghdadi illegitimate, and then we see ISIS trying to get Al-Qaeda's affiliates and allies to defect and join ISIS. It seems like these two groups are ultimately battling for recognition as like the global vanguard of Salafi jihadism. So where do you see this battle going? You know, in 5 or 10 years, are they still going to be locked in this struggle? Or will one group sort of, you know, force the other group to submit? You know, and if so, like, who's going to come out on top?
I think that for the jihadi movement, there is room for both groups, because there are some significant ideological differences, especially the attitude towards the Shia. And so these kind of differences are going to be hard to reconcile. They existed from the time that Al-Qaeda merged with Zarqawi in Iraq. And Al-Qaeda was hopeful that it would be able to control Zarqawi, and that Zarqawi will follow Al-Qaeda Central's view of how you deal with the Shia and with minorities. This is not just a matter of strategy. I think this is truly a matter of also beliefs. So these kind of differences are going to exist, which means that it makes sense that there will be two competing jihadi groups, each assuming its own location within the jihadi movement. Now, what's going to happen with those two in the future? A lot depends on who's going to be alive in the leadership. I think that it's going to be harder for the Islamic State to change its ways, because they put so much emphasis on establishing the caliphate and on forcing others to submit to them that it's really hard for me to see how they say, okay, we're not going to do that anymore, and we're willing to change our way, especially not while Baghdadi is alive. I don't see Al-Qaeda willing to accept the authority of the Islamic State as long as Zawahiri is alive. And now they definitely don't have any reason to do that, because the Islamic State is losing territories. Just because the Islamic State is capable of killing lots of people in lots of places doesn't mean that they are the winning horse now that Al-Qaeda feels forced to actually follow. Al-Qaeda managed to resist the Islamic State at times when the Islamic State appeared invincible, where there was a strong push even from within Al-Qaeda, from operatives within Al-Qaeda, to join the Islamic State, and Al-Qaeda resisted that. I don't see why Al-Qaeda would now agree to any kind of change, unless it's going to be a change on its own terms, which is not that hard. They're willing to cooperate. But the Islamic State, Baghdadi and Al-Adnani don't seem to be heading this way. So not anytime soon. It's really hard right now to imagine the Islamic State actually being on top. At the same time, the decline of the Islamic State might be followed by a few years of quiet and then reemergence. So maybe in 10 years, the situation is going to be different and dynamic is going to be different, but not anytime soon.
No, I agree. Like Baghdadi and Zawahiri, they're not working together anytime soon, even though Zawahiri has said many times, you know, we need complete unity. But then I almost think the subtext is, but not under Baghdadi.
Well, of course.
Yeah. So, but in, you know, in 10 years, you could have completely different leadership in both those groups. And could you see some sort of, you know, merger to, like, to form almost like a new group?
It's hard to say no.
Yeah.
It's,
I mean, in 10 years is a long way off.
It's long time from now. A lot depends on whether remnants of the Islamic State will try to cling to the idea of the caliphate. If they will cling to the idea of the caliphate, it's going to be very hard to any other group to join them, unless they will come up with some kind of formula where they can maintain the caliphate or the claims of the caliphate, but allow for cooperation with actors that don't pledge allegiance. And that might be the kind of compromise that will work out eventually, where both sides save face, they don't make too significant compromises. So that seems to me most likely. I don't know what kind of maneuvering they will need to do in order to justify how you can have the caliphate but backing down from all your demands that everybody else will dismantle and accept your authority. But they are pretty flexible when it comes to finding justifications when you really need it.
True. I know we've seen a lot of small groups of Al-Qaeda members defect to ISIS. Do you think any of the bigger affiliates would completely defect to ISIS? Or, you know, would they strike out on their own? You know, I know there's, for a while, there was, you know, some open source reporting that AQIM had completely defected to ISIS. And no, that wasn't true. They're still in AQIM. Do you think any of those groups would completely defect to ISIS?
I don't see any group completely defecting to ISIS. I was pretty astonished to see how resilient Al-Qaeda was. The fact that it managed to withstand the onslaught of the Islamic State at the time where the Islamic State really seemed to be rolling and doing so well. And none of Al-Qaeda's branches changed their allegiance. Maybe small factions within those groups, but nothing really significant. Very few in leadership positions.
Mm-hmm.
And if Al-Qaeda managed to survive that when the Islamic State was strong, I don't see any reason why branches will change their allegiance now. It's especially astonishing that the resilience, because Al-Qaeda lost two branch leaders in Yemen and in Somalia, and that gave those branches a chance to reorient and to realign with the Islamic State, and yet they chose to stay with Al-Qaeda.
I thought it was interesting in sort of that year period where we didn't hear from Zawahiri, we'd get joint statements from, you know, AQIP, AQIM, and the Nusra Front. So they were sort of like reaffirming, like, no, we're one network that just has different branches. I thought that was really interesting.
And they did a pretty good job at that. They managed to keep Al-Shabaab,
yeah,
which was pretty impressive. Now, whether one of those groups decide to strike on their own, I just don't see why they would, unless there is a complete change of direction from Al-Qaeda, which we don't expect to see anytime soon. There is just no reason. Since 2003, since Al-Qaeda started its branching out, it was only the Iraqi branch that really seemed like somebody that would actually try to go against Al-Qaeda Central, that actually had real inspirations, transnational inspirations. I don't see any other candidate among those that are still now with Al-Qaeda that will decide to go on their own. I don't see what they're going to benefit from that.
You know, a few minutes ago, you talked about how, you know, ISIS is losing territory. They're losing the amount of people they can tax and raise funds for the group. But there's been some open source reporting of fighters who just want to leave. They want to go home. They do not want to be part of the Islamic State anymore. And some of those people are probably former Al-Qaeda members. Do you think Al-Qaeda would welcome those people back? Because they'll certainly welcome ISIS fighters who want to just come over to Al-Qaeda. But will they welcome back those people that were maybe traitors a year or two ago?
They might, few of them, but they will need to do serious vetting, since we know that ISIS penetrates organizations, have people pretending to be loyal to their organizations, and then they suddenly show up as a cell of the Islamic State that was just inserted into a different organization in order to bring it down from within. So I'm sure that Al-Qaeda is going to be extremely cautious, you know, with anybody that comes from the Islamic State. I'm sure that they will take some people that could have operational qualities, but they will probably try to keep them away from other people that they were close to in the past, so that there won't be that opportunity for those cells to emerge. Al-Qaeda, I'm sure, will welcome some of the leadership of the Islamic State if that can give them some kind of propaganda value, showing that somebody important really defected. But in general, Al-Qaeda is going to be extremely cautious.
They've always been very careful about anyone who wants to come join their group. So I'm sure they'll just kick it up a couple notches.
Yeah, they will have to do some serious vetting to make sure that Islamic State is not tricking them again.
Mm-hmm. It always seems like Al-Qaeda and ISIS are sort of in this, you know, class of their own among all the terrorist groups in the world. You know, why do you think that is? Is it just because of their level and sophistication of attacks? Or is there something more threatening, like they can threaten the sovereignty of a state? And so that's why we're so, you know, watchful and careful about Al-Qaeda and ISIS.
I think that lots of actors can threaten the sovereignty of states. In my mind, the main reason why they are a league of their own, as you said, is that because they are transnational. There's no other group that is transnational that managed to score such successes. And our impression is usually based on the kind of attacks that reach the West.
Mm-hmm.
So that sometimes biases us, but both organizations that manage to do operations that we hear about, that's the main reason why I think that they are a league of their own. Another is that I just don't see any other organization that is not affiliated yet that is a potential competitor. Now, with regardless to the level of sophistication, not the only one that shows sophistication, just to remind you that the Mumbai attack was Lashkar-e-Taiba.
Mm-hmm.
And they basically set a precedent that now we see all groups trying to follow, the kind of separate teams going with firearms, taking hostages, shooting in the streets, creating mm-hmm. chaos in the cities. This is something that we didn't hear about until 2008, where most of the focus was on just the threat of suicide bombing. And that was considered a very sophisticated operation.
Mm-hmm.
But it just shows that sophistication is not just with Al-Qaeda and Islamic State.
And I know after the Paris attacks last year, we actually started comparing the Mumbai attacks to Paris. And then last week after the Bangladesh attack, you know, I was sitting with one of our detectives and he said, do you think this is like Mumbai and Paris? Like, is this going to be followed by other attacks? And so we were kind of watching the news, seeing if, you know, that would happen. You know, is Mumbai the new, you know, blueprint for attacks?
I would expect to see more of that in the U.S. than suicide bombing in the U.S.,
mm-hmm.
just because it's easier. If you're just able to put your hands on weapons, mm-hmm. you can cause lots of damage. Suicide bombing is much more complicated.
Yeah, and we've seen Al-Qaeda in their propaganda for a few years now, telling people to attack in your hometown where you're familiar with, attack with weapons you know how to use. And after the incident in Orlando a couple weeks ago, even though the Orlando shooter pledged, you know, allegiance to Baghdadi and ISIS, Al-Qaeda put out that little 3-page Inspire guide, and they actually praised him for using a weapon that he had legally and was an expert with, instead of spending time trying to gather materials for an IED and learning how to put them together and be able to detonate it at the appropriate time.
So it's, it's a combination of sophistication and simplicity. And those organizations keep learning from each other and they continuously search for innovative ways to wreak havoc. But yeah, the point is that sophistication, not just limited to Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State, but yeah, they're definitely the two organizations that we hear about the most. Perhaps Boko Haram is the wild card, those that have aspirations. If I said before that Al-Qaeda branches are unlikely to leave Al-Qaeda as long as Zawahiri is still leading and keeping the organization together, or assuming that the organization is not disintegrating. But in the case of the Islamic State, the alliance with Boko Haram seems very fishy. If I'm the Islamic State leader, I do not trust Boko Haram. So it's more likely to me that the Islamic State can face defections than Al-Qaeda might face defections. And Boko Haram is probably the only other actor that is truly interested in grabbing headlines for itself.
I think I want to move back to Syria for a minute. We've seen a lot of open source reporting saying that Zawahiri was sending some, you know, some pretty senior Al-Qaeda leaders to Syria in an attempt to gain support for a Syrian emirate, which would, of course, be under Al-Qaeda's leadership. How likely do you think it is that Al-Qaeda could gain the support they need for a Syrian emirate?
First of all, I read the stories about that potential emirate. And when I read the story, the main sources actually come from Khorasham. Charles Lister spoke mm-hmm. with the Khorasham leadership. So I wasn't surprised that the way it was depicted emphasized Al-Qaeda's wish to create an emirate in northern Syria. I'm not sure to what extent it actually reflects the position of Al-Qaeda. There is definitely a faction within Jabhat al-Nusra that would like to do that, but the leadership, at least al-Julani, is not interested in that. And I feel pretty confident that the people that Zawahiri sent are not interested in establishing the emirate in Syria. Maybe they're there to actually make sure that There is no emirate in Syria.
Really?
The Jabhat al-Nusra is sticking to the script. But regardless, whether it's going to be an emirate or not depends on the cooperation of other forces, and especially Ahrar al-Sham. And Ahrar al-Sham is not going to go for that kind of emirate. I just don't see the benefit of even establishing that kind of emirate. When Al-Qaeda keeps complaining that the Islamic State, by declaring a caliphate, is dedicating too many resources to actually fighting other rebel groups, other jihadis, instead of actually fighting the main enemies, whether it's going to be Iran, whether it's going to be the Assad regime, whether it's going to be the United States. So for Al-Qaeda to actually follow a very similar direction, and especially at the time where the war is still raging, that's just going to distract them from the main objective. And Al-Qaeda continuously say, no distractions. We need to focus on what's really important. No sidetracking. An emirate in Syria, that would be serious sidetracking. And it's going to change the way that the locals are going to see Al-Qaeda. It's going to make it easier for external actors to go against Jabhat al-Nusra. I just don't see that going beyond.
Yeah, I think it would make Al-Qaeda, it would sort of make the target on their back even larger, which... You know, I think right now they're sort of taking cover with ISIS being, you know, so much in the media, and all these, you know, Western militaries are paying attention to ISIS. I think they're sort of using that time.
It's going to make it harder for Syrian rebel groups to cooperate with them.
Yeah. And the Nusra Front has done such a good job of working with so many different groups.
That would be a self-inflicted wound. It just seems... it's clear that there are some people in Al-Qaeda, in Jabhat al-Nusra, that would like to do that, the more extreme elements. But they are not in a sufficiently strong position for that. And as we said before, they can't do it by themselves. They need the cooperation of other rebel groups. And none of them seem to be interested.
So even if ISIS starts losing even more territory and more fighters, you don't think Al-Qaeda would pursue that Syrian emirate?
I don't think that Al-Qaeda wants to pursue when we think about a Syrian emirate, we need to distinguish between actually governing territory, which doesn't require the announcement of an emirate, and that's something that they're already gradually doing and expanding, and the declaration of an emirate that is also a very political move. It seems to me that they will focus on extending their control and governance rather than hurry to make the political statement that is not backed by the groundwork of governance.
Okay. I think we probably have to wrap up. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to do this with us. I think to date, this is our longest interview podcast. So, I mean, we've done a couple with, you know, people you work with, Clint Watts, but they're shorter, you know, 10, 15 minutes. So... You got the long one. But to wrap up, if anyone is interested in learning more about Al-Qaeda, I really recommend that they read your book, The Al-Qaeda Franchise, The Expansion of Al-Qaeda and Its Consequences. But what are some other books or other researchers that you really recommend to people to get, you know, a deeper dig on Al-Qaeda?
The first book that I would recommend actually speaks about the older period. It's The Arabs at War in Afghanistan by Lia Fall and Mustafa Hamid. That's a fascinating book that tells the story of the 1980s, 1990s in Afghanistan. I think that's an essential reading. Then, of course, Charles Lister, The Syrian Jihad. Yes, there is lots of emphasis also on the Islamic State there, but he tells a very interesting story about the evolution of Al-Qaeda in Syria and the relationship between Jabhat al-Nusra and the other groups, especially Ahrar al-Sham. There is also, a couple of years ago, there was an interesting book called Decoding Al-Qaeda's Strategy by Michael Ryan. I think that's an interesting one. And there is a forthcoming book that I'm looking forward to by Brian Fishman.
Okay.
The Master Plan. In addition to that, of course, you have the regular suspects. Will McCants, Always Follow What He Does.
Yes, we've done a podcast with Will McCants.
Always fantastic. Cole Bonzo,
a terrific
scholar, fascinating work, insights that I haven't heard from anybody else. So he's definitely somebody to follow on anything jihadi. He's a super smart guy and a real authority. So definitely, and of course we have a lot of other people. Aaron Zellin, highly recommended. So yeah, I think that we're lucky to at least have a good number of excellent scholars that work on these objects that can really provide insights. And I'm grateful to be part of that kind of community.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure.
Again, all links can be found in the show notes and on our website at www.njohsp.gov. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to subscribe to Intelligence Unclassified.